Forecasters say that the heat wave currently affecting much of Europe could last for another week. At least 36 people have died across the continent because of the soaring temperatures.
Record temperatures of up to 40 degrees Celsius are forecast for today in Italy, and there's no immediate prospect of relief from Europe's oppressive heat wave.
This is the first time that human beings have known long enough in advance that disaster was going to hit them and have the ability to avoid it.
Inland, where the temperature is almost 10 degrees warmer, it means raging forest fires, drought conditions for farmers, and wilderness parks closed.
While climate experts can't link individual extreme events to global warming, they forecast that by the end of this century, such heat waves could be regarded as normal during a British summer.
The science is not there. This may go down as the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people.
It's possible. We have unwittingly begun a massive experiment with the system of this planet itself, which has led some to fear that we are creating a global heat trap which could lead to climatic instability.
From the moment it was first raised on the world stage by Margaret Thatcher in 1988, the science of climate change has been tangled up in politics. Seeing herself as the champion of science, Mrs. Thatcher made that landmark speech to the Royal Society. One of the things she liked about science was the sense of certainty it gave her. At one early Downing Street meeting on global warming, she's said to have told her Chancellor and Foreign Secretary, "You're not here to speak, you're here to listen." But even 15 years on, the reality is that both science and politics of climate change are battlefields. While an international study only last week concluded that a million species are at imminent risk from climate change, there's continuing argument in the scientific journals over the human contribution to global warming, particularly through burning oil and coal. And there's deadlock between the planet's biggest polluter, the US, and much of the rest of the world as to what global action is needed to deal with it. One of the areas of almost universal agreement is that the Earth is currently warming at a rate which no one alive has seen before. It's not just that last year's summer was scorching. At the Climatic Research Unit in the University of East Anglia, Professor Phil Jones sees the emergence of a new pattern.
The temperatures in 2003 will be roughly the same as they were in 2002, and so it will be the joint second warmest year in the whole record, which goes back to 1861. Neither of the last 2 years actually beat 1998, which is about 0.55 degrees Celsius warmer than the 1961 to 90 average, so for the average for those 30 years. But it's a lot more alarming than that, because it's not only these 3 years that have been very warm. The 10 warmest years have all occurred since 1990. And since 1861, we've seen a warming of about 0.6 degrees Celsius in the global average temperature.
If this pattern continues, as Professor Jones expects, the climate of the 21st century will go through significant shifts.
The global average is going to continue to warm, something in the region of about 0.2 of a degree C per decade, and that rate might start to accelerate as we move further into the 21st century if we don't do anything about the changes. So we'll be about 2.5 degrees Celsius warmer than we are today by the time we get to 2100. And 2.5 degrees is quite a lot when you consider it's four times the rise that's been experienced during the 20th century. And it's half the difference between an ice age and the present. And so it's an enormous change to our climate.
But how these current changes in climate fit into the great tapestry of the Earth's history is a matter of debate. Internationally, there's a wide scientific consensus that what's happening now has no precedent in the past millennium. It's a wide consensus, but by no means complete. One scientific approach is to reconstruct temperature records for the past 1,000 years. The difficulty is that reliable meteorological readings only go back to 1861, and then only for the Northern Hemisphere. Before that, global temperatures must be estimated from a variety of indirect sources known as proxy measures, such as the growth rates of ancient corals, the geographical spread of vegetation, or the annual growth rings inside trees. These are each specialist fields of study. At the University of East Anglia, the professor of dendroclimatology, the relations between tree rings and climate, is Keith Briffer. his discipline has established techniques leading to some points of certainty.
This is actually a piece of very ancient pine which has been preserved for about, in this case, 6,000 years, the sample we're looking at here.
And it's a disc cut across the tree about, what is it, 10 inches across?
Yeah, it's about a 10-inch roundel from right across the stem of a pine which grew in northern Sweden. What you can see here is that the actual ring width variability from year to year is really well preserved. So you can measure the change in the ring width value from year to year right the way out through the whole record of there, and you have a year-to-year change in something which was causing that tree to grow well or grow narrowly from year to year. And it so happens in this area, we know that summer temperatures are very, very strong influence on the growth. So you're looking there at several hundred years of summer temperature variability, though with great uncertainty because it's only represented in one sample here.
And even these very narrow rings that are crowded in here can give you reliable information, can they?
Well, the secret is that you would never rely on just one tree, but by going to an area like this and sampling many, many trees, and then what we call cross-dating them, we can put together like a giant jigsaw puzzle. We can put a very long, continuous record together, which can go back thousands of years. In fact, these records do go back 7,000 to 8,000 years in northern Scandinavia.
But while Professor Briffer and his colleagues may be able to identify a particular tree ring as dating precisely, say, from the Battle of Hastings, they can only estimate temperature that year by interpretation of data like the ring's width and the density of its wood. The resulting uncertainty becomes most controversial when evidence from several proxy measures is combined to estimate global temperatures over the past millennia. The United Nations has brought the world's experts together in an intergovernmental panel on climate change, the IPCC, to give their combined assessments of the data. The most recent, in 2001, drew heavily on computer reconstructions of the last 1,000 years and gave particular prominence to one from a team led by Professor Michael Mann of the University of Virginia. In the continuing scientific argument over climate change, Professor Mann has emerged as a leading champion of the majority view among climate scientists.
Okay. What we have here is a map of the various locations over the globe where we have proxy information from natural archives like corals and tree rings and ice cores that can tell us something about how the climate changed on a year-to-year basis back through the 17th, 16th, 15th century, back to AD 1000. What we have here are some tree ring records from Europe and from a large part of North America, as well as northern Eurasia, some ice cores.
And what have you been able to do with these data?
Well, when we assimilate all this information, we average over the entire northern hemisphere to get a single record, a record of what we think the changes have been in the average temperature of the northern hemisphere back 1,000 years in time.
Using Professor Mann's and other reconstructions, the international panel thought it likely that the increase in temperature in the 20th century was the largest of any century in the past 1,000 years, and that the 1990s were the warmest decade and 1998 the warmest year. They gave a compelling graph, plotting temperature from 1000 to 2000 AD. It's become known as the hockey stick graph, put together by Michael Mann.
So this black line that wiggles up and down from 1000 AD and then suddenly shoots up from the mid-20th century, that's what?
That is kind of a smoothed version of these year-to-year variations that we reconstruct in the northern hemisphere average temperature 1,000 years back in time. The gray region shows the level of uncertainty. It's roughly speaking, it's the region in which we're 95% confident the actual value occurred relative to our best estimate. And the striking thing in that comparison is that the late 20th century, that's the red curve here, is seen to exceed that region of uncertainty in the reconstructions of the past.
That's where it shoots up here and is higher than anything there's been before.
Yes, in essence, with a 95% level of confidence, we can state that the late 20th century warming is unprecedented in 1,000 years.
Professor Mann's 95% confidence is not the international consensus. The UN panel gives a probability of 2/3, meaning it's twice as likely as not that something unusual is happening. But even this is challenged by climate skeptics. Their case is presented by two astrophysicists at Harvard University, Drs. Willie Soon and Sally Balunas, whose long-standing interest is the influence of changes in the sun on climate. They set off a furious and politically influential disagreement last year when they claimed that current global warming is not unprecedented and may even have been exceeded in the Middle Ages.
We went through about 1,000 research papers in the peer review literature, and we wanted to ask some very simple questions. In the past, in a particular region, given a different environmental indicator, was there an extreme in the past, and how did that extreme compare to the 20th century? So we just let the experts speak for themselves and made a large table of these results. And in the parts of the world where there was information, there usually was an extreme sometime between 800 and 1300 AD.
Extreme meaning what?
Extreme meaning whatever indicator one is looking at. It might be temperature, but it might be wind, it might be sea salinity, it might be precipitation. So, but an extreme of 50 years or more. And did that occur during a well-defined period, 800 to 1300 AD, a period that had been defined by past expert researchers as having been unusual? Then we asked, did the opposite extreme occur between 1400 to 1900 over a 50-year or longer period? And then the third question we asked was, how did the 20th century compare back? Was it the most extreme? And we found that it wasn't, in general, the most extreme over the areas of the world where there was information.
Give me a specific example or two of what you found that would compare with what's happened in the late 20th century.
Yes, I can speak to that. A very clear example would be, say, the limit of the tree lines in Siberia, for example. You would find some 1,000 years ago, for example, during the period that Sally mentioned, from 800 to 1300 AD, that the tree line was actually growing higher up in elevation from today. So that actually implies condition of maybe more wet in the atmosphere and actually conditioned as much more warmer than today.
And that was which period?
That is exactly 1,000 years ago, let's say in a location like Siberia.
Willie Soon and Sally Balunas present an account of the past millennium in which a warm period in the Middle Ages up to about 1400 AD was followed by a little ice age up to the 19th century. The warming of the past decades, they say, only seems unusual because we're all emerging from the cold. In particular, they cast doubt on Michael Mann's hockey stick graph and reject the three main conclusions of the UN panel. Uncertainty over the evidence, they say, undermines the claims that the 20th century warmed faster than any other, the 1990s were the warmest decade, and 1998 the warmest year. Politically, the impact of this analysis is huge. Look at the hockey stick graph, and it's hard to avoid a sense of alarm at what we are doing to our planet. But if the Harvard team are right, and what's happening now is merely natural variability, less than the warming in the Middle Ages, then what's the problem? The world survived then. The analysis by Dr. Soon and Dr. Balunas has become a cause célèbre in Washington, with help from a think tank they're linked to, the Marshall Institute, which has long argued against controls on fossil fuel emissions. Its president, William O'Keefe, spent 25 years representing the oil industry in the American Petroleum Institute. Now he says he still has an agenda, but not the one environmentalists suspect.
We do have an agenda, and the agenda is to make sure that the integrity of science is protected and that it is clearly conveyed to policymakers and the public. And in the climate change area, I personally believe, and the Institute believes, that science has been misused to a great extent, and that one of the dangers is that the public will lose faith in the scientific establishment.
What then is the political impact of the published research suggesting that the human influence on global warming may have been seriously overestimated?
Well, the impact is that it affects the types of policies that you make and their impact on economic activity, because in the end, Most of the emissions of concern come from the use of fossil fuels, and fossil fuels fuel economic activity. So there's a direct connection between emissions and economic activity, and the actions you take as a country have to bring into balance risk and benefits and consequences.
On this side of the argument, the Marshall Institute dismisses the idea of a scientific consensus on global warming, stressing instead the doubts raised by skeptics like Dr. Soon and Balunas at Harvard. This is the scientific and political front line of the climate war, and it's become personal. The champion for the majority view, Professor Michael Mann, dismisses the Harvard team's conclusions as a misrepresentation of the evidence.
There is a considerable amount of regional variability in climate from year to year. An excellent case in point would be the El Nino year of 1997-1998, where large parts of the tropical Pacific Ocean were warmer than usual. The northern hemisphere, and in fact the globe, was a couple tenths of a degree warmer than usual due to the effects of El Nino. But also due to the effects of El Nino, certain regions were actually colder than usual. That is an excellent analog for really how the climate changes on almost all timescales. There is considerable spatial variability intrinsic in the dynamics and the physics that govern the climate system.
They present their findings as reasons for not being alarmed at the idea of human-made global warming happening now by suggesting that similar warming may have happened 1,000 years ago and the Earth and humankind came through, so what's the problem? How do you interpret their findings?
Yeah, well, again, they didn't interpret the evidence correctly. It's certainly true that particular regions of the globe and particular regions of the northern hemisphere in past centuries experienced anomalies, be they wet or cold or warm or dry, that may very well be sizable and similar in magnitude to those anomalies that have occurred in those regions during the 20th century. What is unique about the late 20th century, not so much the entire 20th century, but the latter half of the 20th century, is that the vast majority of regions have been warming simultaneously.
So to upset your analysis,
they would have to have shown that disparate regions of the globe during a similar 50-year period showed simultaneous warming similar to that that we have experienced during the late 20th century, and they haven't shown that at all.
Professor Mann has misunderstood our work because we believe that climate is more broad than just temperature.
But what Professor Mann says is that what you've come up with is patchy data which show that a particular part of the globe may have had an unusually warm period 1,000 years ago. He says the extraordinary thing, and he says unique thing, about the late 20th century is the simultaneous warmth indicated by nearly all long-term records.
But when he says long-term records, there's a little bit of confusion here. Does he mean the thermometer records? Because that is what he uses for the late 20th century. He cuts his proxy data off at 1980.
What if he means, if it's the instrumental record?
Then he's right that in the last 150 years, yes, the late 20th century has been unusually warm. But 150 years is too short a baseline over which to make a dramatic statement that the 20th century is unusual compared to the last millennium.
But wouldn't you need to show something comparable? Of course, you haven't got temperature records from 1,000 years ago. But wouldn't you need to show from these so-called proxy records something comparable, that in many parts of the globe, a 50-year period shows indications of unusual warmth?
But we did show that 50-year periods are unusually warm in parts
but
of the world.
But not for one 50-year period dotted not, around the globe.
Not simultaneously, but the information is telling one that the climate is patchy.
Dr. Balunas's position was immensely strengthened by having her research with Dr. Soon published in an international peer-reviewed scientific journal, Climate Research. But inside the journal itself, concern was quickly raised about their study's reliability. One of the journal's editors, Professor Hans von Storch of Hamburg University, called the paper flawed and said it should not have been published because its result could not be concluded from its evidence. There's limited significance, he argues, in finding evidence of a patchwork of different 50-year warm periods in different parts of the globe.
It has no value as a test. That means it is rather arbitrary. If I would collect in a somewhat different way, then I could show that this medieval warm period was particularly cold, possibly, if I'm just looking for 50-year episodes which were cold somewhere. In any case, these were questions which would have been raised to the authors in the review process, and the paper should have not been published without addressing these problems explicitly.
But the paper had actually been through the journal's review process.
Yeah.
What had gone wrong?
Well, I have to speculate about that. The review process of the journal was organized in such a way that we had something like 8 or so independent editors who acted on themselves. The guy who had this paper said he had applied something like maybe 4, even 5 reviewers, and so he had been, he claims to have been very careful, and maybe he was, but I later on got confidentially the review of one of the reviewers, and these key questions about the representativity of 50-year episodes, for instance, were already questions in that review. So the editor should have told the authors, well, you have to answer these questions, and if you do not do that in the proper way, we cannot publish it.
And is that what happened?
That is not what happened. And the fault is with the journal. The journal failed in its standard of a proper review process.
The authors, Drs. Willy Soon and Sally Balunas, told me the problem is that Professor von Storch doesn't understand their work. He insists that the problem is the work itself, which he understands perfectly well. But despite this fundamental challenge, once published, the Harvard paper found friends in high places. It was presented at a special hearing of the Environment Committee of the U.S. Senate, whose chairman, the Republican Senator James Inhofe, lambasted doomsayers and alarmists in the environmental movement, a position he defended at a press conference last month.
I find that people here have been so entrenched in this for the last 10, 12, 14 years that this is the centrix of their lives. This is all they really care about. So I started, when I became chairman of this committee, to look at the science. And I couldn't find a lot of science that would justify other than the Michael Mann science and the hockey stick. And that's why I used that to show what type of science was there. And the science is not there. And I said in a speech on the floor, which has been quoted, I think perhaps this may go down as the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people. And it appears to me that that could be the case.
But hoax implies deliberate intent. What's the motivation?
Well, I'd look up the various different definitions of hoax. I'm not sure how deliberate the intent was.
May I make a suggestion, Mr. Chairman? The motivation by the IPPC is probably self-perpetuation, which is the motivation of most bureaucracies, and they're not given to reevaluation, but rather to justification.
Republican Congressman Chris Cannon adding that final comment. President Bush, too, was apparently impressed by the Harvard paper. He's said to have put it on the table at a cabinet meeting, saying he'd just read it and wanted the rest of his administration to do so. But the dispute over this research triggered a split between the White House and American government scientists. We've been able to speak to some of those involved on both sides. Last summer, shortly after the Harvard study was published, the White House was accused of tampering with scientific evidence. The accusation came from officials of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. A leaked memo revealed a bitter row over what was to be said about global warming in the agency's annual report.
The White House has made major edits to the climate change section of the EPA's report on the environment, indicating that, quote, no further changes may be made. The section does not address the effects of climate change on human health and the environment. This will be conspicuously different from other chapters of the report. Most important, the report no longer accurately represents scientific consensus on climate change.
This is a serious charge that the White House wanted to bend the evidence on global warming. The Environmental Protection Agency's former climate policy advisor under President Clinton and briefly President Bush is Jeremy Simons. The memo was leaked to his environmental organization, and he sees it as an indication of deep unease among the government's experts.
Well,
often in the climate change debate, new scientific studies emerge. And there was a new scientific study at the time that was funded in part by the American Petroleum Institute.
Is this the Soon and Balloonist study?
This is the Soon and Balloonist study. It's been very controversial. They wanted that study referenced, and they wanted to take out language that had been approved by the U.S. National Academies of Sciences that said that climate change was a real and established threat. They wanted to basically sow confusion into the debate on the science.
The fact that staff at the EPA wrote this memo and that it was leaked to the press suggests a degree of unrest within the agency.
There's definitely been a growing rift between the White House and EPA. EPA really is an agency in crisis right now because the White House has an agenda. They know what their environmental agenda is. It's closely aligned with what industry wants it to pursue. And that doesn't often match up with what the science is. The EPA staff objectives are actually fairly straightforward. It's to get good information out. And that's been a conflict with the spin that the White House has wanted to put on environmental measures.
I was able to meet one well-informed insider at the Environmental Protection Agency to discuss this conflict with the White House. They wouldn't be recorded, but agreed that we could quote their words anonymously. This memo, they said, reflected the lowest morale in the EPA's history. Was there, I asked, any doubt among the agency's experts on the human cause of climate change?
Not within the rank and file of the agency. The staff, who are closest to the science, adhere to the mainstream. They believe that the Intergovernmental Panel is the largest collection of international scientists expert in the field. Advances have only bolstered the view of the human component in global warming. But while officials maintain that, it's the political managers who make the decision as to how the science is used.
The Environmental Protection Agency was unable to resolve this dispute with the White House and ducked out. Its latest report runs to 450 pages, covering every conceivable threat to the environment in detail, except climate change, where it says merely that it won't attempt to address the complexities of the issue. From the White House side, this fight was led by the President's Council on Environmental Quality, based in one of the elegant former townhouses on Lafayette Square, across from the Oval Office. The Council's chairman, James Connerton, denies any intention of fiddling the science.
The U.S. government has already published hundreds and hundreds of pages on our scientific process and scientific conclusions about climate change just in the year preceding that alone. And, you know, this whole issue turned over differences of opinion over one or two sentences.
Well, somebody
in this area, you've been studying it for some time. There are strongly held views about how best to summarize what reports and studies are concluding.
They weren't worried about how you summarized it. What they were effectively saying, not to mince words, is that you were trying to cook the books.
I go back to the point I raised earlier, which is if that was the case, then we would not have published literally hundreds of pages and tens of thousands of lines of government-vetted and government-released discussion on the science of climate change.
Isn't there a doubt, though, about the integrity of the policy process here, that scientists present a summary of what they think is the scientific consensus? You and others in the administration suggest changes to it, and those people in the Environmental Protection Agency end up saying that what you have done would poorly represent the science. That's a very basic charge.
It is the fact that scientists across the U.S. government participated very collaboratively and constructively in producing our climate action report, in producing our 10-year strategic plan on the climate science, which the U.S. funds more climate science than the rest of the world combined. And that was done collaboratively, collectively, and in large measure with consensus. And so to the extent people are taking issue with one or two sentences and different expressions and formulations of you that are summarizing what the scientists have to say, you know, that's the give and take of the governmental process.
Give and take or political bullying of scientists to bend the evidence. The whistleblower I met was distressed that the Environmental Protection Agency failed to say anything about the biggest environmental question of our time in its latest annual report.
Many people ask why the agency succumbed to the White House rather than fulfill its obligation to the public. If I were outside the agency, I'd be concerned about it. I'd question the use of my tax dollars. But by and large, the agency has lost sight of that. Any sense of political controversy and there's a reticence to talk about it. People fear for their jobs. I think it comes down to that. Look at the White House Council on Environmental Quality. It's run by a former lawyer for fossil fuel companies and an executive from the American Petroleum Institute. It looks like a classic case of the fox guarding the chicken coop. Why these serious conflicts of interest go unaddressed boggles the mind.
But the current climate wars are being fought not only within the U.S. government. In the past couple of months, battle has also been joined in the U.S. courts. A conservative think tank, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, filed the first lawsuit under new legislation, the Data Quality Act, challenging government studies on climate, particularly an official report on the potential impact of climate change on regions of the United States. The think tank's director of global warming policy, Myron Ebell, who initiated the case, wanted this climate assessment to be seen as propaganda rather than science.
The problem is regulators tend not to follow science, but to find the science that supports what they want to do in terms of regulating people. So the Data Quality Act was an attempt by Congress to put some controls on the misuse of science by regulatory agencies in government. And we consider these climate reports to be based on junk science. They, in fact, will not pass the Laugh test. What's called the National Assessment on Climate Change, Pat Michaels at the University of Virginia pointed out that the two models used for regional impacts of climate change in the United States, that those two models did not do any better job at predicting the past century's climate than tables of random numbers. So how can you base policy on what is essentially throwing darts at a dartboard? And our lawsuit contended that the National Assessment on Climate Change was based on non-objective, biased, and laughably inadequate science.
The case was settled without coming to trial, with the U.S. government agreeing to put a note on its website saying the climate assessment had not been subjected to data quality guidelines. Even this somewhat Delphic formulation brought pained response from the report's authors. One of them, Professor Eric Barron of Pennsylvania State University, points out that the study was published before the act came into force and argues that it would meet the required standards if put to the test. As for the climate models they used, the point was not to test their accuracy, but to examine the likely regional impacts from models at either end of the range of estimates of global warming.
You know, every model has some characteristics which I think are imperfect, and to tell you the truth, we will live with some level of imperfection in those models for many, many decades. I think that's one of the reasons why we have to ask more than one question. How important are the possible changes?
And do you recognize phrases like junk science, which were thrown at you over that case?
Well, I think that that makes pretty good soundbite, but if you were to ask me what I would do differently about the National Assessment of Climate Impacts, I wouldn't have released it anywhere close to a presidential election. I mean, I think that's just something that has actually made it much more contentious than it actually was. And if you'd waited 6 months or you'd done it, you know, 10 months beforehand, I think some of these things that we're talking about may not have even happened.
Professor Barron questions, too, the value of putting scientific differences on trial in a federal courtroom.
You do have to worry if you get to the point where you don't want to know something and you don't want it to be investigated because you're worried about the answer. I think if you cross that line, then that's the point where you start to do true damage to the test of ideas in the marketplace that makes science in this country so strong.
And is that yet the position in Washington?
I don't think that's fully the position in Washington, but to tell you the truth, a focus like the Competitive Enterprise Institute and what they were attempting to do, that's very much within that type of scope, and that's what I view as relatively dangerous.
Disputes are common in all branches of science. They're vital to the process of discovery. But the unusually vociferous battle over climate science, of course, stems from the importance of fossil fuels to economic growth, especially for the Bush administration, oil. Globally, hazards from greenhouse gases are at the heart of the row over the dryly named Kyoto Protocol, the international mechanism to control emissions. there's a deep political divide, and on either side, rhetoric is apocalyptic. Compare the anti-Kyoto American conservative Myron Ebell with the pro-Kyoto British conservative John Gummer.
I don't think it helps to convince people if you are apocalyptic about things. But I do believe that we are in a very special position. We know that if we do not change our habits, the climate of this world will first of all become increasingly inconvenient for everyone. It will become absolutely impossible for the islands which sink beneath the sea, and then ultimately it could mean that this very fragile planet will die. I have no doubt that we could kill our own planet.
The forces of darkness are simply those people who think that modern industrial civilization has reached the end of the road and we need to start turning off the lights. So you have a vast environmental movement that's funded by huge charitable foundations and by European governments. You have a huge international bureaucracy now, and they really do believe industrial civilization needs to be stopped and that we do need to start turning out the lights. And that's the whole purpose behind the Kyoto Protocol.
The future of the Kyoto Protocol is in the balance. On one side, 120 nations have ratified it. On the other, the biggest single emitter, the United States, has refused. Russia is undecided, holds the key to the protocol's survival, and is making the most of its moment.